Hello, I'm Andrew Mail, and you're listening to the Mojo Record Club, a place where music lovers, musicians, crate diggers, writers, readers, and special guests get to share their love for classic albums, weird lost gems, brand new revelations. Hello, Mojo Record Club listeners. Now, since there's a lot of talk about REM at the moment following their reunion at the Songwriters Hall of Fame, we thought it would be a nice idea to re-up this interview we did with Peter Buck back in 2022. Back then, the Mojo Record Club was a subscription-only podcast, so there is a good chance that a lot of you might have missed it the first time round. Peter was on to talk about his new album with Our Pop curmudgeon Luke Haynes, but mostly we talked about his love for Laura Nero's eternally beguiling and cryptic 1978 LP, Eli and the 13th Confession, an album that initially appears to be a pop soul record, then gradually reveals itself to be anything but. Peter was absolutely fascinating, and it was one of those instances where someone opens up an album for you and reveals all of its inner intricacies. I hope you enjoy it. I'm Andrew Mail, and you're listening to the Mojo Record Club. Was Pilgrimage, composed by Barry Buck Mills Stipe from the 1983 REM album Murmur. Peter, the first thing I need to say is I'm absolutely delighted that you were willing to do this. I'm really pleased for two reasons. One, because I think you've chosen an amazing album to talk about, Laura Nero's Eli and the 13th Confession. But also, firstly, I want to talk about the new album that you've worked on. It's a collaborative album. It's the second album that you've recorded with Mr. Luke Haynes of the Auteurs and Black Box Record after 2020's Beat Poetry for Survivalists. It's called Why Are All the Kids Super Bummed Out? And
the kids are all super bummed out.
Ah, yeah.
There's no why because we know why.
Oh, or maybe the answer is in the record. This is kind of the record provides the answer. The kids are all super bummed out. And to these ears, it would appear to be a particularly kind of occult British punk psychedelia. I heard bits of the Bevis Frond in there. I heard the adverts. I heard the Soft Boys. I mean, I know you've both been interested in each other's music since the early 90s, but how did you finally meet up? How did that come about?
I'm not one of those people who goes on the computer much, but every now and again, I'll go to a music site or a political site. And usually the political ones make me angry, but the music ones are okay.
Yeah.
And one of the music sites mentioned that Luke was selling paintings, and I just emailed him and said, hey, you know, I'm interested. How do I take care of this? And a few weeks later, he wrote and suggested we work together. He tells me that at the time I said, yeah, I'm pretty busy. I don't know. But I seem to remember that I was exactly in the middle of making a record, and the idea of committing to doing something else was really intense. But, you know, 2 weeks later, I was a little more free, and I sent him kind of a semi-finished track. Essentially, the entire record is chronological in the order I sent him stuff.
Yeah.
So Jack Parsons was the first song.
Yes. And what is it about, because you're very much fans of each other's stuff. What is it about Luke's lyrics, his songwriting, and his delivery that appeals to you? What kind of mean? Because he's a unique musician. There are kind of, you hear that voice and you know who it is. So what was it particularly about his, you know, his unique style that appealed to you and made you want to work with him?
I had his first, the Auteurs' first record, New Wave, as a promo cassette in like 94. And it was just, classic songwriting.
Yeah.
A couple of songs remind me of like a really good Ray Davies song.
Very much so, yeah.
But, you know, he pretty quickly moved away from that. And I like just the grounds he touched. There's certainly, I could hear krautrock in there. And there's almost an entire glam record, right? So, you know, it never would have occurred to me to write the guy to ask to write songs together, but he brought it up and it was like, well, I've got songs. I mean, he writes like I do kind of all the time and pointlessly, like some people smoke cigarettes just one after the other.
Yeah.
And I just this morning I got back one I sent him last week. You know, we're still trying to come up with more songs. So it's just an outlet for both of us. And at some point, I kind of realized it doesn't have to have any shape or structure or form. I'll send him something and he'll figure something out.
Yeah. And are you, who's kind of sparking it off? Are you sending him musical ideas first? Is he sending you lyrics? I mean, or does it work both ways?
You know, I've never written to lyrics that someone's given me.
Yeah.
I mean, I've sat in a room with people who have lyrics and you do that. But if someone sent me a printed page, I'm not even sure how I'd go about doing that.
Yeah.
So it's Scott McCoy, who I work with in every band I'm in pretty much, has a home studio in the basement. And generally once a week I go over and record something new of mine, maybe work on something new of his, work with, you know, people send me stuff. So this working through the mail thing is not that unusual for me. Back in the 70s, it was like, oh, you got to send a Learjet for the guy and put him at, you know, at the Ritz and get a bunch of cocaine and a $100,000 guitar and he'll do the session. But, you know, now it's like, hey, want to play on this? Yes, go ahead and send it to me. And it's kind of freeing because it's not like being in a real studio. We don't get charged by the hour. You know, I usually will give people kind of what they want and then some things that they haven't asked for. Usually a little bit more noisy or disruptive. So it's an interesting process, you know.
It feels like much more of a collaborative sound than the first one, which I mean, I like Beat Poetry for Survivalists, but this one sounds like a band, you know, and it sounds like kind of, you know, if you'd have told me that you had recorded it in a room together, I would have believed you because of the sound that you've kind of captured on there.
Yeah, you know, it was exactly the same thing. And during the first few months of COVID, for the first year of COVID, I couldn't go over to Scott's house to record because he's on a medication that would cause him to, you know, have his immune system be not quite as strong. So I was just recording. I have a little crummy recording setup at my house, not even Pro Tools. And I kind of use my phone as the interface for it. And I recorded a bunch of stuff. And at some point, it just became clear to me that form and structure wasn't where I was at that year.
Yeah. I mean,
2020 was not a year that had a lot of linear form. So I just, things started getting a little more out of control and noisier and structureless. And I think that worked really well. I think if I'd taken this stuff in the studio, I'm not sure what would have happened.
Yeah. But I think there's a real sense, the thing I like about it is that that sense in which you embrace the noise, you embrace the riff, and also kind of embrace the weirdness of where Luke is taking his lyrics as ever, you know, the kind of that he's drawing on this kind of, well, with both of them, he's drawing on like a, the in a way to my ears, the first one felt like much closer, like a secret history of America. Whereas this one feels much more like a British record lyrically, that almost like he's more at ease in his own weird world of British arcana on this one.
Yeah. I always kind of see it as a picture of a world that's kind of falling apart and all that's really left are, you know, pop culture D-list celebrities. And then the new record, certainly there's a whole lot of things about communists and fear from the sky. So,
yeah.
And that was all written way before the Ukraine. So who knows, maybe we've tapped into some vein.
He does strike me as some kind of, you know, strange or thaumaturge or kind of, you know, magician. That he kind of, there's a sense in which you imagine he is kind of tapping into, you know, the coming apocalypse or something. The music sort of fits that, you know, with the kind of the nasty kind of organ sound as well in there and just good and dirty guitars. I mean, it's kind of, it's just a thrill to hear you play like that as well. And I'm sure it's a thrill to play like that, you know, as a guitarist.
It's, you know, it's odd to write, you know, there's those few kind of punk rock songs.
Yeah.
And I think those were all done in my spare bedroom to a drum machine, just turned up really loud. It ended up sounding fairly like a band, but generally I have trouble doing faster paced stuff all by myself.
Yeah.
You tend to go for more mid paced things with filigree, but I don't know, maybe I was angry and I just had to set up. I don't think I ever took more than an hour on any of that stuff. It'd be drum machined, three guitars and a bass, and then mailed off to Scott, who would add stuff, and then to Luke.
Maybe you bring it out of each other. You know, maybe you bring out the gnarl and the kind of nasty out of each other, because there's something of that in Luke's imagery all the time. So maybe it's kind of you just tuning into that, slightly kind of warped view of the world.
Yeah, I don't think anyone had a real non-warped view of the world. Thing. I mean, 2020 for everything, not just COVID. You know, we had the protests here.
Yeah.
Trump then sent the feds in, and those guys were just like an execution squad. We have wildfires every year, but
yes,
2020, and we weren't allowed out of the house for a week because I couldn't see the house across the street for all the smoke. And there was kind of a danger that, maybe not at my house, but a lot of my friends' houses were, they had their cars packed.
Yeah.
And you're just like, and then, I think we finished it before January 6th, but it definitely felt like, God, what else? And then I got appendicitis, so there we go.
Yeah. But no, I mean, as a document of the strange times that we're living through, I think it's perfect. You know, it captures something of that madness, which is great. That was Peter Buck and Luke Haynes, The British Army on LSD, from the forthcoming album All the Kids Are Super Bummed Out, written by Buck and Haynes and released on Cherry Red.
It's definitely, I mean, I don't think, if you're the lyricist or whatever, or the guitar player like I am, that you necessarily have to sit down and think about the times you're living in, but you can't really help but be influenced by, in my case, absolute solitude. My car broke down a week before they shut everything down. And I was like, I'll get it done when I come back from Europe. And, 4 months later, it's like I haven't been anywhere that isn't like 2 miles from my house. It was like I'd say hello to neighbors on the street and go indoors. And, that's kind of where the British Army and LSD and the commies are coming come from. It's like just going to my room and making this absolute chaotic racket.
Yeah. But also, both with both of you, I think you've kind of nailed it there, that sense of with the lyrics as well, a sense of a mind left too much on its own, and kind of slightly unraveling.
Yeah, I didn't feel particularly unraveled. I felt really calm and collected. And, I thought, okay, I'm going to write 1,000 songs. I'm going to be walking 7 or 8 miles a day. I'll do my whatever little meditation things I do. I'm going to be really focused when this is over in 4 months. And 4 months didn't quite do it. But I think everybody found a way to deal with it.
Yeah. But also, as you say, everyone did go a little mad and just seeing the world turn, to the far right, and to see kind of a sense of, fascism's back or whatever, kind of was not pleasant to watch.
No. I think a lot of people really had a real serious problem with it. And most of the people I talked to were okay, and a few maybe not. But I think it's toughened people up a lot. It's like, okay, what else you got to throw at me?
Yeah, the sense of like, not willing to stand for it anymore. It would be interesting to see kind of how everything develops. But as an album that captures the strangeness of the times, I think it's absolutely spot on.
Yeah, I mean, the title comes, my next door neighbor is a doctor, and I was talking to her, in 2020. I was asking, God, how are you dealing with this? Are you all right? She goes, yeah, I'm fine. I went to medical school. I've been dealing with infectious disease in my life. But she said, all the kids are super bummed out. And I think I sent some music to Luke, and I went, you know, all the kids are super bummed out is a pretty good title.
Yes. No, that's fantastic, because I'd immediately assumed that would have come from Luke's brain. So the fact that it was kind of came from yours. I mean, is that kind of your one lyrical contribution to the album, or do you send them little ideas and little fragments like that?
He's the lyricist, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I shared a film of, it's on YouTube, it's hard to believe, but in like 1962, the British Army just gave a bunch of soldiers LSD and filmed it, and it was a BBC program.
At Porton Down, wasn't it, I think? Yeah, and it's kind of,
On a personal level, I kept wondering, there are a couple of people that obviously had a bad trip, and there are a couple of people that had a great time, and some crazy, and I just was wondering, what happened to those people?
Yeah.
I mean, I just feel bad for that kind of situation, because I'm sure a fair amount of them had some serious issues. And then what else? I don't know. Oh, yeah, when I sent them what became Can't Get Out of Bed, I just went, yeah, this is one of those bummer in the summer songs. It's 90 degrees out and beautiful. Nothing's open. You know, I've been for a walk. It's like, I guess I'd get back in bed, but that kind of sucks.
You're listening to the Mojo Record Club. It's I went back and listened to the album that you've kind of brought in to discuss today, the Laura Nyro record, and obviously kind of immediately I think, well, there's no point of comparison or line of comparison that I can draw there. But I'd forgotten how genuinely weird this album is, rhythmically and lyrically. So it'd be a nice sort of chance to talk about it. To explain to the listeners, it's Eli and the 13th Confession by the late New York City singer-songwriter Laura Nyro. It was recorded in early 1968 when, astonishingly, Nyro was still only 20 years old. Can you remember when and where you would have first heard it?
You know, at the time I bought it, I was living in a small town in Georgia. It was like 1970 or 71. And I think I read a review. Rolling Stone put out paperback books of collections of their record reviews. And I think there were two or three of them, and I had them all. And I would just kind of go, well, that sounds interesting. And, you know, if I could find it for a quarter, or, you know, records were still $2.75 or $3 or whatever. You know, I could mow a lawn and get that. And so I took a lot of chances, and Eli and the 13th Confession was a record that actually was still in the racks, brand new. I've got my copy right here, and it has the little fold-out thing that went on the cover that tells you who she is, because there's not really any information on the record, front cover. And it's a record that still is really moving to me, because it's really emotional, but I can't really understand where the emotion comes from.
Yeah.
And it's totally in code. There's a lot of reference to the devil and the captain. I know there's drug references in there. I don't know if it's personal or about other people. But musically, it's a stunning record of amazing songs that don't follow any preset pattern, that change tempo and change key. And it's... I played with that record for hundreds of people. And of course, and nowadays, most people, I think, know who she is that listen to music like we do. But, you know, there were years where you just put it on and people go, what the hell is this? It's like, and the answer is, well, you know, this is Laura Nyro and there's nothing else like it.
Can I just check, is it pronounced Nyro or Nyro?
I believe it's Nyro, because her name was Nigro.
Oh, right. Okay. I'm gonna revert to Nyro now for authenticity purposes.
Better, but that's what I think.
And yeah, so I was listening to it and I was thinking, well, you know, because what's fascinating about it is when it begins, you kind of think you've got a measure of it. You kind of know that she's like, let me just get the the tracks in front of me. The first three tracks, you've got Lucky and Lou and Sweet Blindness. And there she's kind of playing around with soul ideas, and you can hear a bit of Motown in there as well. But then you've kind of, and a bit of R&B, but then you've got kind of pop, and then you've got jazz rhythms, and you can hear kind of Broadway show tunes and gospel. And she's just, you know, bringing in all these different ideas. And obviously kind of, I think it's really sympathetically produced, because the, what's the name of the, is it Charlie Colello was the producer, is it? But he obviously brought in people like Zoot Sims and Joe Farrell to play on it. So he could obviously hear what she's doing with all these different kind of rhythms and changes in kind of time signatures as well. I mean, as a musician listening to it, because you said kind of that it's almost like there's something quite cryptic and there's a puzzle about it. Do you sit down and try and think, figure out what is she doing here? How has she written this? Is it something that still kind of beguiles you in terms of kind of how it's assembled?
Yeah, you can't really count on it going from point A to point B.
No.
Even, you know, even verses that are similar are different tempos later in the song.
Yeah.
It definitely, you'd have to have gotten jazz musicians mostly, you know, to play on that. I think Jimmy Vivino, who worked with Conan O'Brien, and he played with Laurie Nero. And I just was quizzing him years ago. I was like, well, what was that like? What was she like to play with? And he goes, she's the only real artist I've ever played with. And, you know, he's like a big time singer.
Yeah.
And he just said she just lived it and breathed it. It was real. And he goes, it was unbelievable. So how that 20-year-old kid got all these 40-year-old jazz musicians to play this stuff that, you know, it's complicated, but it also in some ways doesn't make sense in a jazz way either.
No.
It's completely as if there's some emotional undertow that's just setting the song up in this way that doesn't have to make literal sense.
Who was it? Was it Three Dog Night who covered Eli's Coming? Who was it, the group who covered Eli's Coming?
Yeah, they did that one. The Fifth Dimension did
Stone Soul Picnic, did they?
And Wedding Bell Blues. And I don't know about England, but in America, Barbara Streisand had a top 10 hit with Stony End.
Yeah, it's one of her best albums, isn't it? It's the title track of one of her best albums.
Yeah, that, I mean, I've only heard that record once or twice, but when she was trying to be more of a modern whatever, like she's in jeans and a t-shirt on.
Yeah, and she's on the back of a flatbed truck, I think, isn't she, on the cover?
And you know, she was trying to approach modern singer-songwriters, and that was a great version of that. And pretty much anyone who did covers of her songs seemed to have hits except for herself.
Which is really weird because they lend themselves really well to covers, as you say, Stone Soul Picnic, Eli's Coming, and yet they're so unconventional. They might initially sound like a pop tune, but then you've got the shifts in mood and tempo. They're really eccentric. I mean, I was listening to Eli's Coming today, and you've basically got the trombones are playing one rhythm, the trumpets are playing another, the saxophone is playing another, you know, and yet and then it still holds together as what you might call a pop song. Let's have a listen. This is Eli's Coming from Laura Nero's 1968 LP, Eli and the 13th Confession, written by Laura Nero and released by Sony Music Distribution.
Tempos, you know, like those jazz guys are playing, they can play and stay on the tempo all the time. You know, things appreciably speed up during verses, and it's not an accident. She's going fast, go right along with her.
No.
And, you know, most of the people who had hit singles with her records sanded off a lot of the rough edges.
Yes.
I mean, Eli's Coming, it's a simpler song when Three Dog Night does it. I mean, it's a big rocker, you know, and hers goes through like a couple different permutations till the end.
And the other thing that's weird about it as well is just as well as it being musically cryptic, lyrically, she's obviously kind of, she's got these almost like kind of words that, you know, you might use in a kind of, that the witches in Macbeth might use, like, you know, Surrey and love spell, and phrases like, you know, God is a jigsaw timer. You know, there's something kind of almost ancient and, you know, kind of cryptic about the lyrics.
No, my feeling always was, here's a really, really young woman dealing with a whole lot of stuff. And, you know, it's like pages out of her poetry notebook that aren't necessarily connected.
Mm.
I mean, you get the feeling that as she's singing it, she's feeling every line.
Yes.
She doesn't have to have you know what that line means.
And I remember her saying somewhere about the album, when my mother hears it, she's going to know what I spent the summer doing. You know, so there's an autobiographical journey through the record as well, which kind of, as you say, she's drawing on poetry. She's also drawing on lines from her diary. There's a sense in which she's writing about, you know, her 19th summer or whatever, and the people that she met, which for someone who's so young, there's a real darkness to the record, isn't there?
Yeah, I hesitate to even suggest that I would know what she was writing about, but it seemed to me that it was a series of pictures of a person or people that she was with in that chaotic year, and that there were drugs involved and maybe a relationship that was soured by drugs, you know?
Yeah.
And I wouldn't go any farther than that. And other than, you know, I believe she was a Catholic, and there's, you know, and then the back photo is certainly religious in, or it could be just a cute picture of like a mother kissing her daughter, but that's not her daughter. It totally gave me a biblical feel. So, you know, who knows? Maybe it's just her attempting to give a blessing to the people who listen to the record.
What are your thoughts on, because you go back and listen to the first record, and she's singing very differently on the first record. The first record is vocally is much more conventional as well. And her use of the upper register on this album, which is kind of one of the things that turns people, or initially turns people off Laura and Iroh, they kind of listen to it and they go, oh man, you know, where's she going with that vocal? Some people find it quite difficult to take, and it isn't there on the first album. And it feels to me like what she's doing with vocally is kind of tied in with what you're saying about, you know, the journey that she's on with this record. There's a connection between those two things, but I've never been able to figure out, you know, what that connection is. But do you see what I'm kind of reaching for here?
Yeah, well, the first record, she was really young.
Yeah.
Maybe even 17 at the time. And she had these amazing songs and a bunch of studio musicians who didn't really give a shit what she thought, and a producer who thought, well, if we could just get her to shut up and sing the songs and records. And that's what the record sounds like. And it's great on it. I'm not one of those people that dislikes that record, but given that she, from what all intents and purposes, she ran Eli and the 13th Confession. She had a producer, but he's, you know,
well, I think to all him, as far as I can work out, the producer was absolutely in awe of her as well, of just like, and was willing to facilitate and make everything happen. Because I think it was like, well, didn't it go, did the album go ridiculously over budget, like sort of three times the budget of what, you know, an album would have cost back then?
Yeah, I don't know much about the history of it, but yeah, from what I understand, she was in charge, and they did it her way. So yeah, you're not listening to some random stuff. Like, there, you know, as a musician, there are times when I start feeling like the tempo is accelerating, and you just know that that's what it's supposed to, because everyone does it and they do it perfectly.
Yeah,
it's not something that you would go for if you were aiming, you know, for anything other than the feel of what you're doing.
In terms of how she was respected within the industry at that time, have you ever seen those photos? And I think they're from around about the same time, of her at in Stephen Sondheim's flat, and they're kind of hanging out together. Have you ever seen those?
No.
Oh, they're amazing, because like literally she is, you know, this young 20-year-old girl, and he's kind of sitting at his desk looking up at her. But he apparently, and I can't find the exact quote, and it might be one of those things that is kind of apocryphal, but he apparently said of Stone Soul Picnic, he said, in economy, lyricism and melody, it is a masterpiece. Now, coming from most people, that's, you know, that's nice, but this is a man who rarely even said that about his own, you know, or if he did say it about songs, he only ever said it about his own songs. You know, you'd never get Stephen Sondheim complimenting other people's songwriting abilities in that way. So that's kind of astonishing, really, when you think about it, isn't it?
I'm kind of friends with Todd Rundgren, and he was kind of in awe of her. You know, yeah. I don't know if he admit it, but, you know, he took a lot from her, learned a lot from her, and, you know.
I should just apologize. My dog is rolling around on her back at my feet. So have you heard any kind of rumbling then? Well, Peter was talking about Todd Rundgren, and it's my dog's fault, not mine. You can hear. I mean, you kind of listen to those Rundgren albums, and you can definitely, or I think I can, hear an influence of Laura Nyro in there. You know, the use of harmonies, the kind of that sense of like, this is my canvas to put in all my ideas onto this record and not let anybody kind of stand in my way.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite brave of her to be 20 years old and telling all these really sophisticated musicians, this is how you're going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, she did it.
Farmer Joe. I mean, it's like kind of listening again to Farmer. I mean, how many different songs? That's the other thing as well. That sense of like someone else might just kind of say, oh, well, there's about 5 song ideas there. I can work that into 5 songs. No, she puts it all into the one song.
Like I said, I always tend to feel that no matter how intellectualized this stuff was, that it's an emotional record that you can sit down and say, this is why it's a good record. Because in a lot of ways, I wouldn't even know how to describe what goes on in it. And I played it for tons of people who just said, yeah, I've never heard anything like this, really.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of why it has a lasting power I think all the great records are kind of unsolvable puzzles. You can keep going back to them and find new stuff in there that you kind of not found before. And there's a sense in which, and I think it's certainly true of this album, that there's something unresolved there as well. You know, there's something that is kind of incomplete or an unfinished puzzle. You know, it, kind of like what she says, you know, kind of that, like the jigsaw that she sort of says, when God is a jigsaw, you know, there's kind of all these pieces that you want to put together, but you can't quite, you know, it's not something that you can ultimately solve, whether you want to or not.
No, I mean, I think that if you're a spiritual person and you're 20 years old, I think you're supposed to be a little confused and distraught, and you know whatever's going on top and emotionally, it's kind of a spiritual record. And the fact that she didn't spell out that, you know, her belief system is great. It leads, you know, and I still don't know when she talks about God whether it's her boyfriend or God.
Absolutely.
The devil, I have a feeling, might be your boyfriend, but it might be the devil, you know?
And it feels like Eli is the devil as well, you know? That's like kind of there's, you know, there's definitely a sense of dread in Eli's coming, even though at the same time it's celebratory. You've got these kind of contrasting or sort of mixed emotions. And you're right, you know, when you say it's the kind of, you know, it's an album made by a very spiritual 20-year-old, but with someone else, you might expect some naivety to be in there, and I don't hear anything in this record. You know,
it's not pious either. It seems like it's more of a, musically and lyrically, it's more of an exploration than an answer to anything.
So therefore there is nothing resolved and there are no answers, because it's a kind of, as you say, it's an ongoing exploration of something and kind of just it's a working, I mean, that's how it feels like it has a narrative, which I think it does as a record. It's like a working through of something, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I mean, not to compare the records at all, but when we were working on Murmur, I definitely thought of this record on more than one occasion, just because this is our first big thing, and I didn't want to tell people what it was we're doing.
Yeah. Just
listen to it and accept it at the level of, okay, I don't get all the lyrics and I don't know why the music does this. And it doesn't sound like other records of its time. But that's what, that, you know, that's what you build a world.
I think that's why people go back to a record like Murmur, for exactly what we were saying about Eli, that there is something unsolvable and cryptic about it. It still retains a mystery and a magic that, you know, probably even, you know, yourself and Michael couldn't say what it is, because you were kind of caught up in that mystery and magic yourself. And it's probably the same, you know, if we were able to ask Laura Nero about this record, there would be no answers, because the answer is the process that she's kind of going through, to sound vaguely pretentious for a moment, but you know what I mean.
Well, I tend to believe that, you know, once you get the answer, what's the point in asking another question?
Yeah. And also, what's the point in going back to the record? You know, once you kind of feel that there's no reason to go back, you know, and there's no reason to listen to it again. And it was an absolute joy to listen to it, you know, at your suggestion today, because there was so much I'd forgotten about it. And I think so much I'd kind of assumed, because she is also a pop writer. She is a pop lyric, you know, these are pop songs on here. I'd forgotten about how mysterious and complex and strange and haunting a record it is. And when you mentioned Murmur, I was actually going to say, is there anything in Laura Nero's music that you feel has influenced you, you know, in terms of your arrangements or the music that you've kind of, you know, you wrote for REM or, you know, any of the other kind of bands or solo sort of projects that you've been involved in, where you think, no, I can hear that. That's definitely Laura Nero's influence.
You know, I think it's like one of a million things that I listen to that is in my head. And, you know, on the same hand, you could say, well, Exile on Main Street was a huge influence on me, because like Murmur, it's kind of like, yeah, you're not really hearing the lyrics. It's uniform of sound. It's this world. I mean, it's a completely different world.
Mm.
But, you know, I mean, when we were doing Murmur, you know, we spent what seemed like a really long time mixing it to get it to sound like that.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't some accident where, you know, we made things muddy. It's really crystal clear. It's just mixed in a slightly eccentric manner. And, you know, we had Mitch Easter and Don Dixon, who were total experts and pros mixing it. And they knew what we wanted. And, you know, we had long discussions about, should this be louder? Would people, you know, understand it more? And it was kind of like, I want it to play and people just go, what the hell did I just hear?
And it was my response when I first heard it, you know, when I think I'd have bought it just after going to see, I saw you play Liverpool Royal Court in 85. So it would have been on the Reckoning tour. And went out and bought, you know, I'd already bought Reckoning and went out and bought Murmur the next day after seeing you. But yeah, I mean, because, you know, Reckoning is an album that is, you know, it's clear, you know, there are sharp points in it, you know, there's a clarity, there are moments that's, you know, chime like a bell. And then you go into Murmur and you think, this is, you know, this is strange, this is haunted, this record, in a way that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, I mean, that's our feeling. We always described it as Murmur being our third album, because we threw away a lot of songs. We wanted to get to that point where our first record had that kind of, you know, you're not hearing the first time heebie-jeebies. This is a band that has a vision of what they want to do and do it. And Reckoning, you know, like everyone's second album, you know, we'd written 100 songs by then, but, you know, we wrote all of those on tour and finished them mostly in a 2-week rehearsal period. And played them all live on our first really, really huge world tour, where we went, you know, Australia, Japan, all of Europe. So that record kind of, you know, is a little representative of that. You know, we just went in and knocked it out and left.
Yeah, Murmur just blindsided me when I heard it. And we found a snapshot of Peter talking about life in the band, recorded back in the Murmur era. And let's have a listen. It's a fascinating moment in time.
You know, I moved to Athens, I guess, in 1978. 77, something like that. And it was just after, you know, the punk rock thing happened, I guess. And there was no real punk rock scene in Athens, but there's lots of bands and things kind of occurring. The B-52s, I guess, were the first band that people really noticed, with the Tone Tones, Pylon, Method Actors. They're all doing something really interesting and neat. I guess it was the first time in my life I'd ever realized you could be in a band and not be, you know, Ted Nugent or Styx or Journey or something like that. It was just really kind of exciting thing. You know, you'd go see Pylon, who were one of the greatest bands in the world, and there'd be like 100 people there. It cost $1 to get in, beer was 90 cents, everyone would dance. It was just like a fun thing. I mean, being in a band seemed like the ideal way to make a living. It is, you know, 5 years later down the road, it's pretty neat.
You're listening to the Mojo Record Club with me, Andrew Mayle.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you about Laura Nero, she was an artist who made her money through publishing, ultimately, not through record sales, because of the amount of covers of her songs. And that desire to record, to play live, kind of dies out, doesn't it? And do you think, I mean, I kind of wonder about that, whether that affected her reputation, you know, the sense that kind of she retreats, she raises a family, you know, and obviously, tragically, she dies young. So there is a sense that kind of it feels like part of the narrative stops at a certain point. You know, you don't have that continuation of records.
I continued buying her records. I never saw her live because, as far as I know, she never played in Georgia.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, reading about it, she'd do like a series of Christmas shows in New York, you know, almost every year.
Yeah.
And I just wish I'd kind of thought about it. I definitely would have flown up and watched for them, you know, but it didn't really occur to me that, I don't think I ever heard that she was doing that. It was just something that her fans knew.
Yeah, it was. I mean, obviously, kind of, you know, the pre-internet age. You know, these things weren't common knowledge, as you say. It just would have been a local thing for New York fans.
Yeah. So it, in a way, it kind of makes the mystery good. I never saw her in person. You know, I may have read stuff about her, but I don't really know much about her because in some way she might have been unknowable to strangers.
Yeah.
I've probably talked with 4 people who've worked with her. And no one could really pin down and tell me what she was like. But everyone says, "Well, yeah, she was a real artist," and you know.
I think in a way that seems appropriate and right that there is. I mean, you don't want to get too poetic about this because obviously, kind of, it was a real life and it was a short life, and you know, this was a creative person. But that sense of kind of the albums that I've talked about on this podcast. The ones that seem to last are the ones that retain a mystery, that, you know, there are a puzzle that isn't kind of completely solved, that you feel you'll keep going back to it and find something else there, and, you know, nothing will be totally answered. I think, I mean, absolutely delighted that you chose this record because it was such a joy to go back and visit it and find, as you said, that my first response is, I don't understand this record, and yet it works.
Yeah, I spent hours with headphones reading the lyric sheet, listening to it, and, you know, I understand it on a visceral level, intellectualize all I want to about it, but, you know, I'm not certain that that's even the point of it.
It's kind of, there's the religious, you know, kind of comes up as a subject when we talk, you know, because we were talking about one of the podcasts, we were talking to Warren Ellis about Alice Coltrane, and in a recent podcast we were talking about Dope Smoker by Sleep. And these albums that have a kind of almost sort of ritualistic religious quality to them, that they are, you know, that you kind of listen to the record and you enter into that, the church of that person, which kind of seems right in the context of Laura and I, right? That you're in that world, and like kind of, you know, religion or spirituality, the meaning is elusive.
Yeah, like I said, I don't really expect any answers from this record. It's enough to put it on and play it and feel like you've gone from the beginning to the end, and that was the experience that this, you know, young woman wanted me to have, and it's an extraordinary experience.
Peter, absolutely fantastic. A joy and a delight to talk to you about that record. Thank you so much.
It was great talking to you.
You're listening to the Mojo Record. There. You're listening to the Mojo Record Club.
You have been listening to Peter Buck, and myself, Andrew Mayle. Look in the episode description for full details of all the tracks we played. Hope to see you at the next one. You've been listening to the Mojo Record Club with me, Andrew Mayle, and my cat, Klaus, sitting on my shoulder. I know, isn't he ridiculous? To use the Scottish word, he's quite a souk, as in he just needs to be wherever he thinks it's warmest. And sometimes it's warmest on my shoulder. Now, while it's still warm, let us pour in all the mystery.